Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Joe Courtney, almost unnoticed through all the other haze and fog by a lot of people, is the failure of the Defense of Marriage Act as articulated by the Supreme Court of the United States. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, again, it was an attempt 17 years ago to have the federal government sort of override what was an area of the law that had traditionally been completely the province of state government, which is defining the law of marriage. And, you know, again, if you think about it, you know, the traditional oath at a marriage was, you know, by the laws invested in me by the state of blank. Right. You know, that kind of shows that, you know, that's always been an area that states have really had control over. The law of divorce, the law of child custody, the law of child support, the law of alimony, these were all determined at the state by the state government. And so the decision by the Congress to certainly put its big footprint on and define marriage was, I think, just a real questionable legal premise and project from day one.
Why do you think they did it?
Well, I think, you know, go back in time. I mean, the politics of gay marriage was something that, I think the country was at a place right at then where it was politically unpopular. So, there was this move which, President Clinton signed that law into effect, that bill into effect, and made it a law. And I think there was definitely a large majority of Democrats in the House at the time who voted for it. So, the politics of and where the country was at that time, was definitely in a different place than it is today. And that's what's really, to me, the most interesting sort of takeaway from the Supreme Court's decision, which is that anybody who thinks that the Supreme Court doesn't read the newspapers and follow what's going on in society, they really should watch the way, DOMA was struck down, because that clearly was the case where the court was sort of following, the change in culture in the U.S. as opposed to leading it.
Certainly was a change in culture. I'm fascinated, however, with one swing justice who tells us he's a libertarian, and then, that becomes a 5-4 to strike down these two pieces of either legislation or whatever, and does. So what do you make of that?
Well, again, Justice Kennedy, is somebody that was on the front page of Time magazine a year or so ago, and, he's always been identified as somebody who, was not a knee-jerk justice in terms of lining up with the different blocks. Again, I thought, his decision in the healthcare law was pretty knee-jerk, in my opinion, and his interpretation of the Commerce Clause was very disappointing. But having said that, he has shown, a willingness to step out from the Scalia block and the Roberts block. And so, that most of the folks who watch the court for a living, the Jeff Toobins of the world, I mean, they actually pretty much nailed this one from day one as where they thought he would go.
He's supposed to be a libertarian. In your mind, what's the difference between a libertarian and a Republican?
Well, I guess, traditionally, if you look at Republican judges, I mean, they always usually were pretty pro-government in terms of issues of criminal justice and, government agency authority. And so to the extent that, he is characterizes himself as a libertarian, I guess he would sort of fall outside that traditional definition. But again, the Republican Party right now is something that, we're all sort of scratching our heads, certainly in Washington, watching the House Republican Caucus, which is as splintered and, a body. I mean, Bob Dole's comment is that the party, the national party, should be closed for repairs. I thought it was really, a perfect comment in terms of just, this is not your grandfather or your father's Republican Party by any stretch, the guys that are down here in D.C.
Joe Courtney, I wanted to riff with you a little bit about, or wanted you to riff on student loans. To me, one of the great disgraces in America is that you would double the amount, you know, of interest that people would have to pay who took out a student loan in a land which considers itself, both by Democrats and Republicans, one of equality of opportunity. This is pretty bad news for the higher education people.
It is. And I think, you know, one thing that sometimes gets lost in the discussion is that, you know, the student loan program is not a drain on the Treasury. If you look at this program, which is a loan program, you know, people pay it back the principal plus interest. The fact is it's a net winner for the Treasury. And, you know, even with the default rate in the Stafford loan program, which is roughly, you know, 8 or 9%, CBO, Congressional Budget Office, scores the net revenue windfall to the Treasury at about $50 billion a year. So the students are not, should not be bashful or feel that they're, asking taxpayers to do something that, you know, will cause a drain again on the budget deficit. And you know, the reason why I think Stafford came into existence, though, is because the private student loan market is even rougher than the government student loan market, and that's because when banks look at an 18-year-old coming through the door, you know, all they see is risk. Because they don't have collateral that they can put up, you know, to borrow to go to school, and gambling on you know, that type of risk for a lot of banks pushes interest rates up to an even higher level, and I think a lot of your listeners know that the private student loan market is even higher than the 6.8% that the Stafford loan program is built around. So, you know, we're at this really ridiculous place right now where. You know, again, even with some of the uptick in home mortgage prices, we're looking at student loan interest rates that are much higher than consumer debt in other parts of the economy. And as you point out, you know, higher education is still the great equalizer. You know, this is something that is almost essential for people to succeed in life. We know that in this recession, people with 2-year and 4-year degrees have much lower unemployment rates than people with high school degrees, and yet, at a time when we have baby boomers leaving the workforce, we need to you know, refresh the workforce. You know, we're creating a higher obstacle for people to pay for college, which is still the number one disincentive for people to go to school or to finish their degree program. So, you know, again, I'm somebody who had 195 colleagues sign on to a bill to extend the lower rate. But the fact is, Alan, we need to have a much bigger conversation in this country about this whole issue. And you know, I think you could argue, well, why should students be, you know, paying in to the Treasury above just the true net cost of loans? Why should this be a windfall for the federal government? And also, I mean, we should be doing more to push colleges and universities to moderate the rate of growth, which is obviously part of the problem that's driving student loan debt higher.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you really quickly, because we only have a minute and a half, and we have to stick with that, but I wanted to ask you about immigration. You think we'll ever see an immigration bill in the House?
Well, certainly, you know, what happened in the Senate was so impressive to see 68 votes in this polarized environment come together. We've got a good bipartisan working group in the House that's working on it. But, I mean, at the end of the day, this really comes down to, you know, John Boehner's ability to control this splintered caucus that we just talked about and whether he can get them to come together for a comprehensive bill with a pathway to citizenship. It doesn't have to be identical to the Senate, but that is the, you know, and there's a lot of spectators watching the collapse of the Farm Bill and watching how sequester, you know, went into effect that have grave doubts about whether or not this historic opportunity is something that the country is going to see actually materialize.
Okay, since we have 30 seconds left, guns in Connecticut. I know we had this awful tragedy in Newtown. Are you satisfied with where we're going?
I mean, the Manchin bill background check for people with criminal records at private gun sales and people with mental illness. It's A, totally constitutional, even under the most, you know, harsh reading of Justice Scalia's Heller case decision, and B, it's something that 90% of the public supports. And it's just, Harry Reid has, you know, adamant that he is going to bring that bill back, and again, hopefully the external pressure in the country is going to force a totally common sense, reasonable measure like that through.
Joe Courtney, we always love it when you're on with us. Joe Courtney is Democrat of the Connecticut 2nd District. He's been in office since 2007. He's articulate, and you're very good to show up, Joe. Thanks again.
I'll be back. Thanks, Alan.